Okay, so we have passed through the hours of the night. So now we are in our last weekend. We approach the horizon. We approach the process of the arising of Ra, the sunrise moment. Now we are in the day. Now we're above ground. We're not in the underworld. We are letting our light shine. We're supported by all the work that we've done in these past 2 years. And, you know, as Holly was saying earlier, we've done a lot. We've covered a lot of material. Of course, there's much, much more material in the Book of Gates, which as the weekend goes on, I'll talk more about. And so there are many, many more layers, really, to be uncovered in this text. But one of the key points of this moment, really, is to concentrate on the shining, to trust the journey that has been undertaken, not to be worried about what you remember or don't remember, but to trust that you have made the journey. And everybody's journey will have had similar characteristics and profound differences. But one of the key things and the key aspects of Egyptian tradition is that you don't look back. You move on to meet the next moment. You do look back, you recapitulate. It's a spiral process. But you don't recapitulate at this point. At this point, you trust that the will, the imagination is moving through you. Through this image the Egyptians call the Eye of Ra, who is Hathor Sekhmet. We're going to talk a good deal this weekend about the goddess Hathor, whom we haven't talked very much about. Mainly we have seen Hathor as the Lady of the West, Lady of the West. She is the cow arising out of the mountains of the Valley of the Kings, who receives the soul into the West. And that is one of her functions. She is the welcomer, she is the nourisher, she is the Lady of Turquoise and Beauty, who receives. But she is also the living eye of Ra, who shines upon the land. She is also the living tree of life, the lady of the sycamore tree, and there's great images of her offering sweet water and shade and shelter. So she represents the growth, the fertility of the life, the fertility of the land, expressing itself in the moment of the day. Now, if we look at where we are just today, I don't know how it is where you are, but here the sun is shining, the roses are opening, there is much greenness, there is much growth and life. And this is this kind of territory, this energy the Egyptians talk about of the new world, the new day coming into being. You know, you find it in the great hymn to the of the Atim, of the fish jumping for joy in the morning, the birds flying out of their nests and their wings praising the soul of Amun-Ra, human beings standing upright and giving praise for the delight of the sun, the delight of the new day, for the sheer exuberance of light that shines on all without diminution, the great enormous generosity of the sun, where it gives itself fully, totally, in the new moment to everybody. We can hide from the sun, but all you have to do to receive the full blessing of the sun is to make yourself available to the sun. I mean, that's true obviously on literal levels, but it's true on inner levels as well. To receive the living light, to trust in the journey you have undertaken, to not hide or cover yourself, to be uplifted by the seat that uplifts you, So this great image you have in the front of the Book of Gates, which is the image of completion, really, of seated on the serpent. Now, the whole journey of the Book of Gates has been an encounter with serpent upon serpent. Serpent guardians at different points, whether they will let you through doors or not. The great spiral serpent of Mehen that travels in the bark of Ra with you, protects you and filters all disturbance. The serpent Apep, that is the serpent of entropy, who tries to stop the process of life. The great Uraeus serpents, the protective serpents who breathe fire, who purify us as we pass through the gates, and who empower and protect us. So the serpent energy has many, you know, is our own life energy. It's the energy that can, so this energy that can, the amazing energy of the bisexuality of the serpent, that can be the phallic symbol, that can be the serpent with breasts as Renenutet, that can feed us as the mother feeds us. The serpent who can be a straight line, or can be spiral, or can create improbable creative knots. Now this is our own deep imagination, our own life energy, which as we befriend it, as we work with it, as we unify with it, becomes the seat that upholds us. And then if we are upheld by that seat, we hold in our hands the star of our own being. Now, if you look at the Egyptian image, it's a pentagram. It's a fivefold star. It's both the symbol itself of the deepest of the Ak soul, the deepest part of the human soul, which is this jet, like a star, like a little miniature sun, is a generative source, possessing its own capacity of generation. It also is the true, in its fivefold form, is the true human image. You know, it reminds us of the microcosm of Vitruvius. The human form is essentially two legs, two arms, a head. You know, it's got that fivefold nature. So we hold ourselves there in the true human image, upheld by the seat that upholds us. So this conjunction of will, the conjunction of imagination, that makes us the one now who is the radiant one, the one, this very poetic image, the one whose flesh is gold, whose bones are silver. Remembering that for the Egyptians, silver is more precious than gold. So we are transfigured. Now this is the image of the sense of the thing the Tibetans call the rainbow body, the transfiguration of Christ. This is when the light shines through our flesh, when we become the radiant one, the one who has passed through all the hours of the night and has become reborn. This is the place where in the Gospel of John says, let your light shine, do not hide your light under a bushel, let your light shine before men. This is the challenge, to allow that to happen, to relax into that, not as a another job I have to do, but as something that happens. Because I have passed through the hours of the night, because I have stood with Ra, because I have bound Apep, because I have stood for life and challenged entropy, because I have entered into the communion of those who sit in the lake of fire, who for whom the lake of fire is the lake of sweet water, because I have become the alchemist. And because my presence, my being nature, catalyzes all around me, shines on all around me, even as the sun shines on all that is around it. in ancient Egypt, you know, this image of the one who sits. The other interesting image, actually, is that it's an image of a woman. Doesn't matter what your sex is, you become the woman who sits on the throne, holding the star. You become the woman who can give life. You know, this is not a point about sexual gender. It's about the ability to generate life, to bring out of the mystery, to bring new life. So in the myth, really, it's the infant son that is born, who is each day is swallowed by the goddess Nutu, travels through the underworld, and then emerges, is born out of the vulva of Nut, and there's a great image, really, which I'll show you later, of the sun shining out of the vulva of Nut, shining upon the face of Hathor, who is the Eye of Ra, the solar goddess who arises out of the womb of... Now, because of kind of the way Western culture has developed, we mainly think of goddesses as lunar. But Hathor is the great solar goddess of Egypt. So we, in a way, the sense of whether as masculine or feminine, we think of ourselves as the woman sitting upon the snake. We also have to think of Hathor as the goddess of the sun, the goddess who impregnates. We have to relax into a different, more expanded sense of understanding the opposites. Because this whole territory of the Book of the Day is the shining, is the emergence of that which is going to emerge. It is the unstoppable power of life. Now that image of the woman seated upon the snake holding the star is founded upon the three great images that you find in Egyptian tradition about the one who upholds Maat, the one who is the catalyst, the generator of Maat. One is the eloquent peasant. Now the image you find for the peasant in ancient Egypt is a little square kind of strip with seeds underneath it, and it has within it the sense of solidity, but the solidity of the fertile land. And there's a great middle Egyptian text, which I'll just see if I can find for a moment.
Your screen's moving about an awful lot.
Sorry. That's because I'm trying to find the text and I'm knocking my computer down. I'm sorry. I'll try to hold it steady while I do that. Bear with me a second. Just want to see if I can find the text that I want to. Oh, here we go. Yeah. So the image of the peasant is this kind of little oblong which represents the solidity of the land with seeds underneath it. The other image you get is a sort of like little crisscross image which represents the irrigated land. Now the eloquent peasant, which is one of the great images of the person who stands for Maat, gives us there's a Middle Egyptian story about a man who's cheated and has his possessions stolen by a nobleman, and taking his stand upon the solidity and the fertility of the earth, he takes his case before the chief steward of Egypt, and then he does these nine amazing speeches challenging the entire Egyptian political system at that time, and in phrases like this: goodness is annihilated, for there is no fidelity to it, no desire to fling deceit backwards upon the earth. If the ferry has been beached, how can one cross the river? Success can be attained only in abomination. To cross the river on foot? Is this a feasible way to cross? Such cannot be done. Let your eyes see, let your heart be instructed. Do not be tyrannical in power, that evil may not overtake you. If you ignore one incident, it will become two. It is the eater who tastes, it is he who is questioned who answers, and it is the sleeper who sees the dream. As for the judge who merits punishment, he is an archetype for him who does wrong. Idiot, behold, you are struck. You know nothing, and behold, you are questioned. You are empty vessel, and behold, you are exposed. Helmsman, do not let your ship veer off course. Giver of life, do not let men die. Provider, do not let men perish. Sunshade, do not attract the heat of the sun. Refuge, do not let the crocodile carry me off. This is the fourth time I appeal to you. Must I spend all my time at it? Now this is remarkable, powerful little speech out of the out of Middle Egypt. Is about the expression of Maat. It's about taking a stand upon what is true, what upholds you, and speaking whatever is true. And you know, this peasant, this image of the eloquent peasant, is a kind of extraordinary kind of image, really, because this is somebody from the lowest strata of Egyptian society speaking to the chief steward of Egypt, who has literally the power of life and death over him, who can decree anything be done to him. And we get this astonishing phrase of, you know, this is the fourth time I appeal to you. Must I spend all my time doing this? And he pursues this for another five speeches until eventually he is sent to Pharaoh, who listens to the story and decides that he is true, because he has spoken with a just voice. Ma'at karu. This is the whole process that we've been looking at, of speaking with a just voice. Now this is the speaking that comes out of the sphere of Da'at in the middle pillar. This is the expression of new life, the expression of what is true, that enters into the place of balance in Tif, that comes out of Keter, the place of deep being, that emerges out of Da'at, that is balanced in Tiferet, that acquires life and vigor in Yesod, and comes into physical active expression in Malchut. This is the process of Ma'at Karu, speaking with a just voice. So this is one of the great images, really, that you find in Egypt. Now the other image you get for one who is the person of Ma'at is the image of Pharaoh himself. Pharaoh is seen, and this is the interesting conjunction you get in the story of the, because the chief steward will not listen to him. He has to come before Pharaoh, whose name means the great house, the one who is the house in himself, the house of Ra, who enables, is himself the presence of Ra made flesh, the living image of the divine. This is why the pharaohs are always given a Horus name, which indicates their identity with the elder Horus, who is the one of the most ancient gods of the sun. You know, if we look at Seti I, he is called the good divine one, the image of Ra, who causes the two lands to live through his rays. Thutmose III is called the image of Ra on earth. Shepenuin II, the sister of the 25th dynasty, Taharqa, who served as the divine wife of Amun, is also called the image of Ra. So this idea that the figure of Pharaoh, who is the living image of Ra on earth, and this dialogue you get between in the eloquent peasant dialogue between the two images of Ra, the peasant who stands for the land, who stands for the solidity of the land, and the Pharaoh who is the living image of Ra on earth. And it is there then that you get that conjunction which enables that things are completed. Now you get, for example, the throne name of Amenhofis III is Neb-Maat Re, meaning the one who is the image of Re, who offers Ma, who is the upholder of truth. And you get this developing image in Egypt of Pharaoh as the divine figure, but always intimately related to being the promoter of Maat. And one of the great offerings that Pharaoh makes is a small bowl which contained a small statue of the goddess Maat, with a single feather and often holding the symbol of life, the Ankh symbol. So this image is of the incarnate God, the living image of Maat and Ra, offering back that quality of Maat which he has enabled to exist through the shining of his light. So this great image you get, this is the second image really of the true human being, being like Pharaoh, being like the other image associated with this is being the shepherd king, the shepherd queen, who protects the flock. And this is why you find the images of Pharaoh holding a crook, which is the shepherd's crook in one hand, which is the place of protection to protect the flock, and holding the flail with the other hand, which is the energy that challenges and beats off the evildoers, and that also threshes the grain to get rid of the husks that obscure the fruit of the wheat. Now this is an image, of course, that you find much later on in the Kabbalah as the klipot, the shells that obscure light. So you're right at the beginning of Egyptian tradition, the need to both protect but also to thresh, to break through the shells so that the light can be the light, the underneath light can be seen and can shine. And this offering, the Maat offering, is the offering that is made back into the source of life, and it's a sort of a circular offering where you offer to the source of life the balance and the beauty that is generated by the source of life. So it becomes this self-generating kind of self-perpetuating process, which is depicted by the Egyptians as the god Kephira, the beetle god, who is the self-begetter, self-generator of life. And this sense of the balanced light, the balanced Maat, as the food of the deities, the food of the God, and the food of all beings, really, that keeps everything in its right order, its right balance, so that everything mirrors each other as it should mirror each other. You find, you know, this, for example, there are prayers that look at this shepherd image. Amun Ra, the shepherd, as you find this in a praise hymn from the New Kingdom. Amun Ra, you shepherd who cares for your flock in early morning and leads the hungry to pasture. As the shepherd leads the flock to the green meadows, Amun Ra, please lead me, the hungry one, to food. For Amen is indeed a shepherd who is not neglectful. Now, of course, you find this image reflected down into Western tradition. You find it classically in Psalm 73, where we get David, who is himself the shepherd king, giving us the Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd." And if we look at Psalm 23, it's not hard to find the Egyptian roots of it. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his namesake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff comfort me." The rod is the flail, the staff is the crook that Pharaoh holds. "Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me in all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." In a certain sense, I will dwell in the house of Pharaoh is the house, the holder of Horus, who shelters all of the flock. I will dwell in this house. So you can very easily there see the ancient resonances of this kind of Egyptian tradition echoing down. And as we know, the Lord is my shepherd becomes one of the great psalms of Western tradition, quoted probably more than any other psalm. And in that psalm there is the journey through the valley of the shadow of the death, which is the journey through the Duat. The other place you find the Good Shepherd is you find the parable of Jesus's parable, where he is taking us through the where he as the looks for the good shepherd, looks for the sheep that is lost, who goes into the desolate places, and to find the places lost, and to gathers the lost sheep and brings the lost sheep home, returning the lost sheep into the bundle of the living. Now the other image you get that connects to this and connects to Pharaoh as the sacred king is linked to the very ancient Egyptian tree of life, the Ished tree. And so you see this image of Ramses II in the Ramesseum seated in the midst of the tree while the god Atum and the goddess Sheshit inscribe his throne names upon the tree. And his name is Usamatra Setepepenra, the chosen one of Ra, who brings the balance and the truth of Ra. You'll also find images of the Tree of Life with Hathor in it, standing in the midst of the tree, suckling Ra. In the roots of the Tree of Life, we find the serpent goddess Renenutet, who is she's depicted there because she is the underworld goddess, who protects us, who suckles us as we work through the night in the initiatory path of the Netherworld books. And by doing this work, by becoming as Ra, by becoming as the eloquent peasant, by becoming the shepherd king, it brings us to the place where our name is inscribed upon the tree, even as the pattern of the tree is inscribed upon our nature. And we discover ourselves as the upholder of Maat, of being the one who is the whole upholder of truth and balance, and in that place is chosen by the divine as the one who must shine. And you'll find this kind of image of the shining one, the one who transmit the qualities of Ma in some of the Egyptian wisdom literature, in the instructions of Merikari in particular, which is a Middle Kingdom wisdom text. We find this verse: well cared for is humankind, who are the flocks of God. Right, see the shepherd image again. We are the flocks of God. He made the earth and the sky for their sakes. He destroyed the danger of the waters for them. He gave the breath of life for their noses. They are his images and come from his person. So again, we're seen as the sheep of Ra, but also the image of Ra. So we are also those who care for humankind, and in a sense we, as we stand for Ra, we destroy the danger of the waters for those who are in trouble. We give the breath of life for those who need breath. We are the images of Ra. We come from the person of the divine. We are the icon, right? The icon who transmit that light. Now all an icon needs to do is to be translucent, is to not be opaque, is to let the light shine through your flesh, so your flesh is gold and your bones are silver, that your eyes are like turquoise. And more as you do this, you do less and less. You become the silent catalyst. Now the other great image you have from Egyptian tradition about the embodiment is Ra, is the image of the human being who they say is Geruma. Now this is the self-mastered human being whose whole body is infused with the qualities of Maat. So this is not somebody who's still, this is infused in stillness. It's like an infusion of oil that is so seeped into us that our very cells are still. We are Geruma, the self-mastered human being. Now in the book of Aminope, which you find written in the 20th century, the Geruma is described as the one who is shade and who provides shade and offers fruit to all that he or she meets, and to enable them to abide in peace in the garden that he and she tend. And we're told that she and he is the one who destroys Isfet, destroys chaos, and brings Maat into being. The root of the word ger, which is at the beginning of geruma, is a word that suggests silence, control, and order. And in a way, this act of promoting mart and destroying isfet is just seen there as a function of the being nature. And a sense of you functioning within your own garden. Again, this sense of just being the shining one within your own garden, the garden of your life, welcoming people into that place, but through the quality of the stillness that is infused in you and therefore is found as perfume within the garden that is yours, that automatically starts to undo chaos, starts to bring in a sense of order, of peacefulness, a sense of place where the light can be received. Now this image of the garden, is central to Western tradition. We find it in the Garden of Eden, where it's used as the image of, where it's used both as an image of perfection and as the image of the loss of perfection. But this image, it was central to ancient Egypt. Now, those of you who have been to Egypt will know that gardens are very precious things in Egypt. You know, in a desert land, you need not just to irrigate, but to carefully tend the garden, to keep attending to it, to keep ensuring that the irrigation is enough but not too much. You have to ensure that one plant doesn't overpower another plant. So that the art of gardening, the art which involves the qualities of the flail and the crook, you protect and you destroy. You need the eye of Ra, that is Hathor, that is the nurturing, the green mother of the sycamore. You need the fiery eye of Ra, that is Sekhmet, that destroys. And these have to be in balance in order for the garden to grow into full beauty. Now, one of the things that, of course, if you visit Egypt these days, when you go to these monuments, they're all desert places. Now, in their day, in the day of the New Kingdom, and if you go to some of, in particular, if you go to Deir el-Bahri, the great temple of Hatshepsut, what would have been there, everywhere there, would have been an enormous garden. There are still stumps of some of the trees that used to be there. But it would have been this enormous fertile garden because it was irrigated by canals from the Nile. So it would have been this place of greenness and beauty. And of course a lot of the colours have gone off the temples so that they also would have reflected colour and beauty. And in a sense that one of the really interesting places you find in Karnak, which is of course the great cathedral place of Egypt, on the east bank of the Nile, opposite the Valley of the Kings. Karnak is the temple of temples; it's a city of temples, really. But it's the old sanctuary of Karnak, which was once a tiny little limestone sanctuary, and is the true heart of Karnak. Well, offset from that, now that the Karnak sanctuary runs east to west, like all Egyptian sanctuaries do, but there is another secret sanctuary, hidden chamber offset.
You've frozen.
All right. Am I back again? Hello, can you hear me? Am I still frozen?
No, you're back now.
I'm back now. Good.
Thanks.
So what I was saying, I don't know how much of that you caught, but I was starting to talk about the sanctuary of Karnak. Did you get that bit? Oh no, Penny, did you get that bit?
You were just beginning to describe it.
Okay, good. So I'll start back there. Okay, so the sanctuary, the sanctuary of Karnak. The old sanctuary of Karnak, which is right in the middle of the temple, next to the sacred lake. Because the hidden sanctuaries always are connected to sacred lakes, because they represent the central mound coming out of the waters of the Nun. Now, offset from the main sanctuary, which is east to west, like all of the Egyptian sanctuaries are, because they represent the rising of the sun and the setting of the sun. The every now and again you get sanctuaries that are connected to the higher priesthood, who work with the netherworld books, who work with the stars that do the circumpolar stars that shine forever. And these are this is the initiation process of those who become those who sit upon the snake and hold the star in their hands. Now these sanctuaries are always situated north to south, orientated north towards the place of the circumpolar stars. Now the version of this you get in Karnak is a hidden chamber offset from the current sanctuary of Amun. And it's called a botanical garden because it's got loads of plants in it. And this is the place where the high priests, the Geru Ma, were made. This is the image of the ancient garden. Now, the ancient garden is the place where the goddess Neith creates the Netaru, creates the gods. And this is the place, and part of the work of the higher priesthood of the Geru Ma is to be the person who sits in the ancient garden and brings the gods into being. So this is the root of the ancient garden, the Garden of Eden. And the priests and priestesses who work here, we could say they are the gardeners of Amun, the gardeners of the hidden god. Now the hidden god Amun, the secret image of Amun, which is never seen, this is always a shrouded image in Egypt, but the secret image of Amun is of a human being. So you have this tiny little statue, very small statue, of a human being who whose flesh is blue, whose flesh is turquoise, but whose deeper but whose body is made of gold and silver. Now this in a certain sense is the image of the Geru Ma, who is, because the sense of turquoise is the sense of the sky. So this is the human being who is on the earth but who is of the sky, who is, has this sense of this huge sense of silence, and who enables the everything. So Amun-Ra is the hidden generative field that enables everything to come into being. The secret image of Amun-Ra is the human image. So the secret image of the human being is being the hidden generative field who brings even the gods into being. So the Geru Ma, the higher priesthood, the one who is infused with silence, from that place of silence brings the divine into being, brings the different forms, the different icons of the divine. So this image we have of the priesthood tending the divine, who bring the statues to life. Now that is an analogue of an even deeper process where we engage with the deep root of being and bring new life into existence, new images into existence. Now that process of internalization you get in Egyptian tradition, you have to look for it a bit. For example, you'll find it's in the 19th dynasty, you find the scribe Neferhotep praying to Ra and saying, "You placed Ma'at within my heart that I may raise her up to your Ka." This is a really good example of the internalization of that externalized Ma'at ritual. So it's not an external ritual now, it's an internal process of intention and prayer, and it points us of the towards the importance of the Ab, the heart, in Egyptian tradition, which in the Kabbalah we would call Tiferet, this place of the heart being a center of awareness, and of us finding our seat within Ma'at. We get the for example a thing called the Maxims of Ptahotep, where he says, "He who obeys his heart will set everything in order." And it is the heart that causes the one, its possessor, to be one who hears, who does not hear. The life, health, and prosperity and stability of a man are in his heart. You know, we get the sense of the heart being the center of will and intelligence, the sun within us, the dwelling, and the dwelling place of the Neteru, the God who is in you. And that is why it's in the mummification process, they place the scarab amulet in the place of the heart. The sense of the heart is the self-generating one, the self-manifesting one. And the power of that self-generating one, this serpent that we sit on, this star that we hold in our hands, is this capacity to create order by aligning with the will of the universe. But it can, of course, also, if we align our will in a different way, we can align it with the will of Apep in order to disrupt in the unfolding of the universe. So this is the great capacity of human choice, of free will. We are generative, whatever we do. So either we generate life, or we generate entropy. Now this depends upon whether we generate icons which transmit the life, or whether we generate idols which obstruct and bend the life around our own personal will that becomes separated from the will of the universe. And central to this, in a way, are the qualities that we find in the middle triangle of the Tree of Life, which is the quality of Geburah, which is the quality of will, the quality of Gedula, which is the quality of love. Finding the balance of love and will, the balance of the crook and the flail in the heart, in that place of Tiferet, It's from that middle triangle which draws upon the deep roots of the tree that we descend in a way into the conditioned self, into the self that is ambivalent. It is sometimes drawn to Apep, sometimes drawn to Ra. And one of the things that is endemic in Egyptian tradition right from the beginning is this balance between Maat and Isfat, between the red land of the desert, between the green and black land of the Nile Valley. And this balance really between water and fire that continually calls upon us to find that right balance. Too much water, you have a swamp, nothing lives. Too much fire, there's a desert where nothing lives. Coming into the sense of centrality, the sense of balance, the sense of our own heart, finding that balance and then trusting the shining that arises out of that. Now that means there is a continual process of needing to find balance, losing balance, finding balance. And as part of that, part of the work that happens, as well as the work of internal finding balance, is then meeting the imbalance, the energies of Apep in the world. Now if we consider these three images of the eloquent peasant, the shepherd king, queen, the Gerumah, how do we meet from this place? If we consider the image of seated upon the serpent, holding the star upon your hand, being the generative source, how do we meet the imbalance of the world? Now the very key thing, very most important thing here, is to remain in our seat, not to go out of our seat. Because when we meet the imbalance of the world, we meet the chaos, we meet the G7, we meet Putin, we meet Boris Johnson, we meet Donald Trump, we meet these powerful external figures. One of the things that very easily can happen to us is we lose our seat. We forget that we are the one whose flesh is gold, our bones are silver. We are the self-generating source of life. We have passed through the hours of the night and been reborn. We see with the two eyes of Ra. We hold the crook and the flail. We are the one who is Gerumah, infused with silence, whose silence is speaking. And as we maintain our seat, as we maintain our connection to this, as we maintain our connection to our shining, anything we touch can be transformed. Little by little, day by day, this is the quality we bring into the world. We continually work with APEP. We continually bring the new sun into being, the new world into being, the new day into being. Now, in a certain sense, that's the great, you know, one of the great gifts the ancient Egyptians had, because their traditions, is this idea of the generation of the new day. We're not chained to the past in that moment. The new sun is reborn. The new day is brought into being. The birds fly out of the nest and their wings praise Ra. The fish leap before his face for joy. The human being stands upon his feet and praises Ra, for life is good. You are uprisen in that moment. Do you see? You are not small. You are not on your knees. You are held up by the seat that upholds you. I don't mean this poetically. I mean this literally. You are upheld by the seat that upholds you. Unless you exercise your free will in a different way and align yourself with the entropic within you. You have an entire right to do that. But then you are then committing yourself to entropy, to the smallness, to the occlusion of light. You become opaque even to yourself. We all do it. And in the next moment, because the next moment is possible, you shine again. You return to the seat. Your seat upholds you. Your name speaks your truth. Your Ren, your name, your resonance in the world is the resonance of Amun Ra, the resonance of Hathor, the resonance of Nit, for whom you are intrinsically woven into the nature of all things. You are the precious node, the link within the weaving, without which the whole weaving unravels. And as such, you walk through the world, bringing things into balance. When Aleister Crowley says it well in his book Moonchild, where we have his figure, his idealized figure of himself, Simon If, who's with his companions in a garden, he perceives a patch of murk, which becomes a large, demonic kind of figure, a place of disturbance. And so his response to this is not to chase it off or to run away and hide. But he chants a line from a book called The Book of the Heart Girt with a Serpent, a beautiful bit of poetry. I, me and mine were sitting with lutes in the marketplace of the great city, the city of the violets and the roses. The night fell and the music of the lutes was stilled. The tempest arose and the music of the lutes was stilled. The hour passed and the music of the lutes was stilled. But thou art eternity and space, thou art matter and motion, and thou art the negation of all these things, for there is no symbol of thee. Now what he does there is to align into becomes the Gerumah, he aligns with the mischievous presence in the heart of which there is no symbol. He goes into this place. He goes into the stillness of his own heart. What he does is this. He makes a link between himself and the disturbance. And he starts to see it more clearly because he starts to relate to the disturbance, the thing in the garden. So he describes this as a thing in the garden. It's a shapeless, dark, red mass. As he links to it, it becomes coherent. The thing became coherent. He could see it now as an animal of the wolf type, sitting down. The body was as big as a small elephant. It became clearly visible. It was a dull, fiery red. Simon F. advanced towards it. He had abandoned his prophetic attitude. His whole gait expressed indifference or even forgetfulness. He was merely a quiet old gentleman taking an evening stroll. He walked right into the thing. As it enveloped him, a faint light issued from his body, a pale phosphorescence which kindled warmly as he went. Those watching saw the edges of the thing contract as if it was sucked inwards. This proceeded and the light became intense. A bout of burning ovoid core dawned and vibrated the flashing colours of the rainbow. The thing disappeared completely. The light went out. Simon If was once again merely an old gentleman taking an evening stroll. And there was a soft voice, almost as faint as an echo, murmuring, "Love is the law, love under will." Now this act of walking gently through the world, meeting and receiving, taking your seat, is displayed beautifully in that little paragraph from the book, where he says he's not chasing anything off or running away. He walks into the thing, he relates to the thing, the thing becomes more coherent, rather frightening, you might think, a wolf-like form, the size of signs of a red elephant, you know, but actually he just walks into it, he embraces it, he brings it into himself, he makes no thing of it, he unites the principles of love and will. And so the thing just boom, pops out, balance is restored, peacefulness is re-established. This is what it is to be Geruma. This is what it is to be the one who shines. This is what it is to be our true nature. To trust the shining within us that comes from our heart. In the meditation, we invite the Ba soul into the heart. We find that combination of groundedness and vision. We see the whole territory of Egypt, the ancient archetype. That we have been, in our ways, in all these 2 years, continually engaging with aspects of. And now we are in the day, we're in the work of the great, you know, there's a work, one of the Sky books called The Book of the Day, which I quoted a bit from right at the beginning of this talk, which is about the shining of the day. The work of the day is different from the work of the night. Work of the night, we engage, we're going into the deep places, we're engaging what we find, we're going into the yes out of the tree of life, engaging with our own inner machinery, needing to work with that. And each time we work with that, we free it a little more, but when we return, and then we are with the shining, we're with the leaning back into the light of the heart that comes through us.
So, would it be fair to say that the usual positions are reversed, that the night time is the time of work and the daytime is the time of being?
Very much so. Very much so. No, that's literally it. So what happens, right? So so what happens in the day is the sun shines. It becomes the infant sun. It shines, it reaches its zenith. Its shining exhausts itself. It becomes, so at the end of the day, the sun is the old sun. You become tired from the work of the work. You become tired from the shining, tired from the act of expression. So then you turn inwards. You go inwards into into the inner landscape. You go inwards into the night. You go inwards into the dream world. You know, and that's that's what happens in the day. But of course, it's because everything, like the universe, is fractal. It is the work of a moment. Also, you shine outwardly, and then you return. You return into stillness. You listen into the stillness. You see what is emerging. You know, it is, it's this fractal repetition, moment by moment, day by day, year by year. But the work of the going inwards, that always is work. I mean, that is where we enter the experience of the inner world. We encounter things, we experience things in the inner, that completes itself, and then we orientate outwards. We let what we've discovered outwards shine through us. It's in Celtic tradition, this idea of going down to Anuven to find the treasures, the hallows of Anuven. You return with those treasures, and then you're the guardian of that treasure, which means you just let the treasure express itself. It's exactly the same principle. So the help that we need in the book of the day is the help is to get out of our own way. We need to be helped not to obstruct the light that is trying to shine through us. You know, that's what Jesus says in that quote from John, "Let your light so shine before men. Do not hide your light." And it goes all the time, we hide our light. You know, we try to, you know, we diminish ourselves. Bob, I think he's trying to say something, but you're muted.
Yet we tire of expressing ourselves.
We become tired, I think, and when we become tired, of course, we need to return inwards. But also, we become fearful of expressing ourselves. Now that's why the in a sense, if you look at these images of Mart, the eloquent peasant image stands upon what he knows to be true. He stands upon the fertile land or the irrigated land. He knows in that place the balance between fire and water. He knows what is true and what works, and then speaks truth. You know, it's a brilliant, it's a magnificent, extraordinary work, the tale of the eloquent peasant, particularly when you consider when he is Middle Egyptian, so this is, you know, 5,000 years ago. So he's speaking to the chiefs, this is a peasant speaking to the chief steward of Egypt, who could literally do anything with him, who tells him that if he has a prejudiced judge, he tells him at one point he's an idiot. He tells him, "I keep on having to tell you this because you're so foolish, you can't understand what I'm saying." You know, so there's in the passive state, but it's so that shining can be very kind of powerful, very direct, very, very clear. You know, in the same way that part of the shining is also acting as the shepherd king, it's acting as the way of finding the lost sheep, bringing the lost sheep home. But all of that is founded on the infusion of silence that you have in the Geruma, the one who is the living tree of life, who catalyzes through silence. Okay, so we've come to our lunchtime period. So we'll come back and look at this more after lunch. So enjoy your lunch, enjoy your shining, and I'll see you all at 1:30. Thanks very much. Cheers.
Thank you, Ian. That was amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you.